Hello and welcome to History in Reverse, a father-daughter science fiction podcast. Today we will be discussing The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. Father-daughter science fiction podcast. My name is Caroline. I'm here with my father, Richie.
Hello.
And we are continuing our project to read a science fiction book every month or two or three or now and then.
Right.
And talk about it. And this month we have read, or this time, this podcast, we have read The Handmaid's Tale by Margaret Atwood. This novel was adapted into several different media versions, most recently a show. Neither of us have watched the show, and I was putting it off, actually, until after we're done with the podcast. But we both have read the book. Now, this is the first time I've read it. Is this the first time you've read it?
Yeah, it's the first time I read it. We actually belong to some local science fiction book discussion group, and both the groups were doing this book as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we attended, and one of them also had shown the movie that was made back in the 90s. And we didn't watch the movie, we just saw the very end.
Yeah.
It seemed to be quite different from the book's end. But
yeah, definitely. It was interesting. So yeah, so at this point, we've been to two book discussion groups to talk about this. Dad, did you know that I like themes? And I think that there are a lot of them in this book.
Oh no, really? So as a little bit of background of Margaret Atwood, so of course, and anyone can look up the Wikipedia entry. She was born in 1939, she's Canadian. But I did see her speak about 10 years ago. There was a place in New York where had authors come in and talk, and she was one of the guests. And around the time, she had written a book called In Other Worlds, which is actually not a fictional book. But it's a collection of essays about science fiction writing. And I haven't read that book. I just remember from her talk that she talked about being 10 years old, going to a cabin and for a summit, for a vacation with the mm-hmm. parents, and then being no TV, no anything, so she would like invent stories and write them down. And
aww.
She always wanted to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the number of works that she has done, she's written quite a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That sounds like an interesting book, actually. I'd like to read that. And I know she, maybe we'll talk about it towards the end after we discuss the plot, she's said before that she just doesn't write science fiction, she writes speculative fiction.
Right.
So we'll come back to that at the end. So what we're going to do is just sort of talk through... First, let's talk about the structure of the way The Handmaid's Tale is written, because it sort of affects the way we are going to describe the plot.
Right, because it's not really linear. It kind of starts up at a particular point in time, and there's recollections
mm-hmm.
To various points in the past that our hero...
Mm-hmm. Offred. Her name is Offred. I know in the TV show she's named as June. In the book she doesn't ever get that name. She's just known as Offred. It's of Fred. So all the handmaids, and she's one of the handmaids, are named for the man they're assigned to.
Right.
And the man she's assigned to is named Fred. So she's of Fred.
The funny thing was when I started to read the book and I saw these names, of Fred, of Glenn, I said, that's strange, Scandinavian sounding
names.
That's
what I thought! So I actually have a friend whose last name starts with O-F-F, and so I didn't know until someone told me that that's what the names meant, and I was like, oh, I completely missed that. But it's really interesting, and it sort of ties into one of the themes of identity, which we'll talk about later.
Right. So let me just say, so the way the story starts, she doesn't talk about her room, she talks about sleeping at the Red Center, right?
Yes.
So she talks about sleeping at the Red Center, which sounds to me like it's the way it's described. It's all full of women sleeping in cots in a large, like, gym,
mm-hmm.
what used to be a gym.
Yeah.
And there's these other women who kind of look after them called the aunts.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of sound a little bit like nuns, in
mm-hmm.
As they would be described in a Catholic school or something.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so that's her first couple of memories are, like, whispering amongst the women who are sleeping in the Red Center. And then I think after that memory, we jump right into her
room. She describes her room. So she,
yeah.
Again, this is kind of basically, she describes what her room is, and her room is very bare. There's just
mm-hmm.
a bed and pretty much nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And she describes all the things that were removed that clearly could be used to commit suicide with. Mm-hmm. So, like, there was no chandelier so you could hang yourself, the glass was not breakable, and there were no sharp objects or anything.
You couldn't open the window wide enough to jump out.
Right.
All kinds of things like that, yeah. And we learn, I think, in that first chapter where she's describing the room, that the previous tenant of the room had committed suicide in that room. Right. And so she's kind of looking around wondering how the previous handmaid had done that. And so we start out with her interactions with some of the people in the house, and we have her interacting with the Marthas in the house.
And story begins. She describes her room, then she describes a shopping trip. Mm-hmm. Right. So we get a glimpse of what society is like. So she has to, first of all, she describes she's dressed in red with the white wings.
With the white wings, yeah. So probably if you guys are aware of the show. The show has a very nice costume set for the handmaids. The white wings, I think based on the text, it's hard to understand what that means. But having seen the images from the show beforehand, I sort of went in knowing. It's kind of like a bonnet that comes down over the face so that people can't really see the handmaid's face. And so the handmaids can't really see more than like just what's directly in front of them. So it's both to shield them from people and from people seeing them and to shield them from seeing other things. And they do wear red. So color, everything is color-coded for your convenience in this story. And the handmaids and all things sort of related to the handmaids and fertility are red. She wears like a long kind of baggy red dress situation.
Right.
She goes downstairs and interacts with the Marthas, the Marthas wear green, if I recall.
Right.
Everybody.
And I don't know if you realize that Marthas in the Bible are the servants.
Oh, that's why. Oh, okay. That doesn't make sense. So yeah, the Marthas in the house are like the servants, exactly. And they give her some, not exactly money, but they give her tokens to go get
tokens
and
shopping
food.
List, right?
Yeah, and a shopping list. And she goes out, but she doesn't go alone. She has to meet somebody. So who does she meet?
She has to meet not the handmaiden. Mm-hmm. Handmaid. I keep calling him handmaidens. And it really means the same thing, kind of.
I think handmaidens more than just like historical handmaidens for like ladies. But yeah, so she meets another handmaid.
Name is Of Glenn. Mm-hmm. Basically, they walk together, and when they greet each other, the greetings are kind of seem religious.
Yes. So this was the first indication we really get that there is a strong religious presence in this society that we're being introduced to. And they say like,
praise be.
Yeah, praise be, and all sorts of things like that. Now the thing about it is, I think this is when she starts to talk about the eyes as well.
Well. And I was just looking at the very first conversation they had, and she mentions the war. So apparently there's a war going on of some sort, and apparently they were fighting Baptists. Mm-hmm. So,
one of the great things about this, and it's being a dystopia, is the amount of information we get is very limited in terms of what's actually happening in the world, and whether or not it's true, we really have no idea.
Right, because pretty much most of the story is told from a point of view of the handmaiden.
Right. Of just Offred, yeah.
Yeah.
So she meets... The thing about meeting with Of Glenn. Is that, Offred, our narrator, doesn't know whether Of Glenn is sincere in her actions, that she sincerely believes in what they're doing, or if she's just acting because she has to for safety purposes. And so it's very risky to expose yourself...
Right, to have any kind of opinions or ask about what else is going on in the world.
Right. So they don't, they don't really have any substantive conversations.
So she describes the trip that they take. So they go, go to the shops, pick up some food, and then they go, there's the wall, which is like the place where, I guess, people who have been punished by death are kind of left displayed, hanging.
Right.
And they always go by the wall just to see if there's anything new hanging out there.
Yeah. And I think that they go in there... There are some bodies the first time they go to the wall. And this is, I think, the first time that Offred thinks about Luke.
Right, so then we get the recollections about what happened in the past. Mm-hmm. So this country, by the way, is called Gilead.
That doesn't come up for a long time.
Really?
The name Gilead doesn't come up for a long time. But yeah, it's called Gilead.
So she has a recollection. So we find out that before all this stuff happened, she lived basically kind of a normal life. Except that she had an affair with this man named Luke, who was married. He got divorced.
He married her,
and they have a child. Well, that there's this throughout the book and throughout the recollections, we find out what happened. But one of the things, she always looks up there. She wants to see if maybe Luke is on the wall.
You know, right.
She believes that he's still alive.
Right.
And it's totally unclear what happened to him.
Right. So
to her daughter.
And to her daughter, yeah. So she, you know, they finish their shopping trip and go back. And, you know, she gives whatever the food is and everything to...
to Martha's
daughter. Oh, but something important happens on the first shopping trip. I believe it was the first shopping trip. They see a handmaiden who's pregnant.
Right.
Do you remember? They see a handmaiden who's pregnant, very heavily pregnant. And everyone kind of is in awe.
Excited. Yeah.
Right. They're all kind of like, oh my God, this is amazing. And they... and she's like glowing, and like it's like all this like wonderful thing, and that's really the first time we're introduced to the idea that there's some connection here with the handmaidens and fertility and pregnancy, that kind of
right.
thing. Because at that early on in the story, like that, we don't really know.
And then there's somewhere a little bit later after that, there's this whole issue of her going to the doctor to be checked out,
right?
Mm-hmm. And the time for the ceremony.
So the doctor she goes to is a man, and she gets basically, we read about her gynecological appointment.
I think it sounds to me like every time she was about to menstruate, or they were trying to determine when it was kind of, when she would be fertile.
Right.
Right.
And the doctor offers her his services in having sex with her.
Well, right. So I think by then we find out that the purpose of the handmaid is to bear a child of the commander, who's the man in charge of the house where she stays.
Right.
Right.
So there seems to be this issue with infertility, and what we find out throughout the story is that there's some kind of infertility issue. Women seem to be the ones that are bearing the brunt of the blame for the infertility and low birth rate thing, but there seems to be a kind of understanding amongst people that like it's also potentially the men having an issue. So the doctor... when she goes to the doctor, he says, you know, hey, you know, I've helped girls before.
If you need to get pregnant,
you know, if you need to get pregnant, I'm here for you. And she says no, because she's afraid of the repercussions of being caught. But she thinks about it.
Right.
You know, she's not against
it. And the repercussions of being caught is being basically killed.
Right. So she says no at that point. But that's an idea that comes up again later with another character. So then basically, you know what else we learned about a little bit early on is the history of the wife. So
we talked, we find out a little bit about the household that she's in.
Right.
So there's the commander, who's the commander. Mm-hmm. There's his wife.
This kind of vague commander of we don't know what.
Yeah, we don't know.
You know, it's just a commander, yeah.
And I think in the little movie that we saw, it implied that he was some kind of military person. But from the book, to me, it seemed like, you know, basically, the man who's the head of the house, that was kind of important. Mm-hmm. They would just call him commander, because they were all commanders with handmaids.
Yeah, exactly. That's they're really, in the book, there's no distinct tie between the commander and, like, an actual military command.
Right.
So it might just be a propaganda kind of word, like some of the other language in the story that, you know, that he's a commander of the household. Right.
Right. So his wife was Serena Joy, and we find out a little bit about her past, and it sounds like she was like a televangelist kind of a person who used to be fairly well known and on television and stuff.
And it sounds like she preached for this kind of society that they ended up in, about, you know, purity and sin and all this kind of stuff. And Offred thinks about the fact that she preached for all these things, and she spoke on having this kind of society, having this kind of control, and now that they're in it, she must hate it so much because it's so bad. And it's kind of like her comeuppance almost to have to live in the world that she said they should create.
Right.
And it seems...
You get feeling of that. I don't think that's entirely...
That Offred thinks about that.
Right.
That she thinks it's like ironic almost. But you get the sense of the story that Serena Joy is not so happy with.
No. She sounds very cynical.
Yeah.
So this was the worst part of the book for me, was the ceremony. That was gross.
So the ceremony, and this is brings up one of the really interesting questions in the story. So the ceremony is basically, the commander has to have sex with the handmaid for her to potentially get pregnant by him. And the reason he has to have sex with her for her to get pregnant is because his wife is infertile, allegedly. Or maybe he's infertile, who knows. But they're saying the wife is infertile. So what they do is they have the wife on the bed, and the handmaid sort of, like, lays against the wife, like, her back against the wife's stomach, right. Like, lays on top of the wife. And then the commander has sex with the handmaid while the wife is behind the handmaid. It's very weird. It sounds very strange.
Very strange, yeah.
One of the, and we'll get to sort of, like, overarching questions, but one of the questions that the story certainly brings up and Alfred sort of thinks about is, like, is this rape when it's, she's sort of, it's like, she thinks it's not. She specifically thinks, like, it's not because she's consenting to the situation. But can you consent to something that you can't really deny? As, like, a great kind of question that the story brings up. So, because Alfred herself doesn't think of it as a rape, but...
And, you know, later on, they do birth in a similar way.
Yeah. It's so weird. Oh, we'll get there. That's, like, so weird. So it's sort of like, you know, this whole concept of the handmaid being the vessel for the baby. And the,
right.
But the baby really being the wives and
right.
stuff
and
like that.
The implication is, from what we hear, is that if a handmaid gets pregnant and has a child, the child is basically given to the wife, and
right.
that's it.
And then the handmaid is, you know, she's completed her task and everything.
And then
like
she can be assigned somewhere else.
Yeah. And she won't be sent to the colonies, which are
right.
The characters are continuously threatened with the concept of the colonies, which are seen to be like a penal colony sort of thing.
Right.
Lord only knows if they're actual or if they're just a threat. We don't know.
Right.
We have no idea. We get through the ceremony and then we sort of get to other memories are happening of the Red Center. So,
right.
Like of Moira.
Well, before we get to that, speaking of the family, so the other thing they do is this reading, right? So
mm-hmm.
handmaids are not allowed to have any literature or not allowed to read.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, they have allowed no information whatsoever.
Right.
Right. So that's why, because the story is told from her point of view, we don't quite know what's going on because she doesn't.
Right, exactly.
Actually, I thought that was really, really effective.
Mm-hmm. I think it's sort of interesting, too, if you think about it in terms of the other dystopias we've read, like, you know, 1984 is a similarly oppressive dystopia.
Right.
But it's sort of in the opposite, where in 1984, it's sort of like the omnipresence of technology is keeping you down.
Right.
Whereas in Handmaid's Tale, it's the total lack of technology
right.
that's keeping you down.
Right, so there is TV and stuff, but handmaids have no access to
right.
it at all.
Right, they can't choose what channels to watch, they can't choose, there's no way to, she doesn't have access to paper or pencils or anything like that,
right.
which makes the way she gets the story out very interesting
right.
at the end. So let's talk a little bit about Moira. So who was Moira?
Right, so when she was in the Red Center, Moira was one of the women there, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of became friends. They went to this elaborate ritual about meeting and talking in the bathroom.
Well,
right.
Actually, she and Moira were friends before they went to the Red Center, remember?
No, you're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, so they would sneak into the bathroom together.
So that was the thing. So because they were constantly watched by the ants,
mm-hmm.
there was impossible to have a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't be overheard.
Mm-hmm.
So the only privacy they had was in the bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they would both kind of go to the bathroom around the same time, and they developed some signals where one would signal the other,
mm-hmm.
you know, come to the bathroom in 3 minutes or 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And they would be in the adjacent stalls, and I think they even drilled a hole or something.
There was a hole. So there was like a way for them to speak to each other in there, and they could only even talk for a few minutes at a time, but they were able to communicate, and Moira basically said, I'm getting out of here. I'm not staying here. And she...
Moira was sound like very spunky, kind of.
Yeah,
easily accepting.
Yeah. And I mean, one thing that's kind of running through the story, too, is it has this very heavy religious kind of influence, in the sense that the government has taken advantage of religious texts to use it to control people. It's that's how the story kind of unfolds. But there's a very strong homophobia. And there's, like,
yes.
some of the men who are hanged at the wall are hanged for being homosexual.
Right.
Moira was a lesbian or something along those lines. And she was in the Red Center and she was kind of seeing this happen and she's like, I can't stay here. This is not going to work. And she did get out.
Right. And then later on we find out how she did it. But I think she tells her after they meet later.
I think that aunt reports how it happens. Because you find out how she gets out pretty early, but then you don't find out what happened after that.
Right.
So,
yeah, so she basically... attacks an ant.
Yeah.
And takes her clothes, she dresses into different, it's a different color dress or whatever. She puts it on and she walks out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, she tied up the ants somewhere and then left it behind, something or other, in the basement or something.
Yeah, it was really smart, very clever. And she's able to escape. So for a long time, you know, Alfred doesn't see her.
Right. So she knows she escaped, but she often wonders. Mm-hmm. But what I found very, spooky, that's scary in the story, was how she describes the transition from like our society, like we are today, mm-hmm. into this society.
Right.
Right. Some of it was very, very, like she describes the day when she. There was a law passed that women are not allowed to have money, or handle money, or work. Mm-hmm. And she didn't, you know, someone didn't call her, tell her about this. Mm-hmm. But she went to the store and they would not take her money.
Yeah.
She got to the office and they would tell her, you know, you don't work here anymore, leave. Mm-hmm. She still had a husband who supported her, but she basically had to stay home. So all of a sudden, like, the whole life was turned completely upside down.
Yeah, and when she and the other women who were working with her at the newspaper, I think it was, she used to work.
Yeah.
When they were being fired, the boss was in there. He's like, you have to go. And he's very nervous. And she could see in, like, the other room that there were these, like, men with, like, large guns, basically.
Yeah. The guardians or something.
Like the prototype of the guardians. Yeah, like, it very suddenly went from, you know...
Normal to abnormal.
Normal to one day it just wasn't anymore. And at this point, when the story, we're starting to get more background about the transition from, you know, U.S. government to Gilead, and more about Luke, and she remembers a lot about the day that they tried to escape.
Right.
So one thing about Gilead was that they would not, under the new regime, accept the marriage between Luke and Offred, because Luke had been married before.
And he
was divorced, and they wouldn't accept divorces. And so Luke and Alfred kind of saw that this was an issue coming down the pipeline, with the fact that their marriage and then their child would not be acceptable, and that they would ultimately be separated due to this impure them living together situation.
Right. And they got fake papers, you know, mm-hmm. falsified papers, passports, so they could go to Canada. Mm-hmm. That's funny, you know, I just realized that Margaret Atwood is Canadian, so naturally they were escaping to Canada.
Yeah. Yeah, so they were, and they were, you know, they put their daughter in the car, and the mom...
And they were pretending like they were just going on a trip.
Yeah, and offered, like, drugs her daughter so she sleeps and stuff, so she doesn't cause a fuss. But somehow they're found out. It's kind of unclear.
Right. So they get to the border, and somebody takes the papers, starts looking at them. And then it's clear that they realized the papers were faked. Mm-hmm. So they try to run away. They basically drive away from the border point and try mm-hmm. to sneak across the border, and they get captured.
Yeah.
And after that time, Alfred doesn't know what happened to Luke or her daughter.
Right.
And she constantly keeps, you know, like when they walk walking past the wall, she often looks to see if she can, mm-hmm. if Luke will show up on the wall. She believes he's alive, but she doesn't know. Mm-hmm.
She has an interesting memory at some point, too, and I'm not quite sure where this fits in, but she has a memory of being in a supermarket before the transition into Gilead, being in a supermarket with Luke, and her daughter was in the, like, cart, in the seat, and she, like, turned around to get something, and she turned back, and her daughter was gone, and a woman had, like, snatched her, and they were able to catch her and get her back. But it was, like, one of the earliest things that Offred remembers as being, like, one of the first early signs of there being this... idea of, like, this kind of, like, frenzy to get children. Because it seems like the infertility kind of issue was setting in.
Right.
And as that was setting in, desire to take children and to have children...
Oh, I see.
...was growing into a frenzy.
That. I didn't think of it that way, yeah. But that makes sense, yeah.
And it was, like, one of, like, the early things she remembers.
So around this time, I think I told you, I've read this book, The Captive Mind, mm-hmm. which is written by this Polish writer who writes about... couple of his friends and how they were changed by living in Poland during World War II. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he talks about in it is this transition from, like, normal life to all of a sudden everything just gets turned upside down. Mm-hmm. And that's why I found this part of this book scary, because it reminded me of that. Mm-hmm. We think that everything is nice and normal, and all mm-hmm. of a sudden something happens you don't expect, and all of a sudden all the old stuff is no longer relevant.
Right, exactly. So we get those memories kind of in the middle of the story, and then we come back to the regular life of the handmaids, and
I think the next kind of
going to the birth, right?
Right, the birth is the
It's not that birth is gross. Birth is fine. The way they do it is weird. So there's a woman who Offred knew beforehand as Janine, who's now known as Offwarren. And Janine's had a rough life. We get some details about Janine's life throughout, and that when she was at the Red Center, she was embarrassed in front of the group because she would cry, and part of that was like she had previously been the victim of sexual assault, and she would say like, "It was my fault." So they were like there's very much a feeling in Gilead that things related to sex, whatever they are the woman's responsibility, whether it's their own sexual assault, their own infertility, or even a man's infertility, it's the woman's fault. Men being attracted to them is their fault. Everything's put on the women, which is, of course, a way to control women. If you can more or less subjugate half the population, you have much more control. It's not surprising in a dystopian society that would happen. So Janine gets pregnant,
right,
as she's supposed to, and she's going to have her baby, and the birth is this whole, like, huge...
It's a ritual, like all the handmaids go and join, hang out, you know, it's like a little party. Mm-hmm. The wives come and have a little party.
Yeah.
When the actual birth happens, the wife has to be present there. So they're like, they're like this double birthing stool.
Yeah, so it's super weird. So it's like the one thing about it is Offred gets to talk to people there because it's so noisy with all the handmaidens that she's able to speak to the handmaidens directly next to her, and they can share information.
Right.
She doesn't learn too much at this birth, but she's able to tell someone else something because someone else is looking for another person. So you kind of get the idea that probably most of the handmaids remember what it was like.
And yeah, there's like a whisper framework, a whisper network rather, amongst the...
Yeah, so the birth happens where, so Janine goes into labor, they put her in like a chair it's like two chairs.
It's a birthing stool.
It's a birthing stool, but above the birthing stool and attached to it is another birthing stool. She goes into labor, and the wife who's going to get the baby ultimately sits behind her and pretends like she's giving birth. It's very strange.
Yes.
And then the baby's born, and then the wife runs over to like a bed, like a hospital bed, and she's given the baby right away. So like Janine never holds the baby or anything along those lines. And then
I think the normal procedure was that the handmaid would feed the baby, breastfeed or something for a while.
Yeah.
And then when the baby was weaned, she would be reassigned.
She'd be moved somewhere else, right? Because they don't want her to have the attachment to the child. Super weird, very strange. We find out later, so the baby initially is born and it's a girl and it looks fine. So one of the concerns is that it's going to be deformed.
Right. And again, it wasn't clear to me what they meant by deformed and what did they expect.
They called it, so the word they used was shredder. They called babies shredders. I don't know if that means you take the baby and then you shred it. It's meant for the shredder. I don't know. I don't know what the term means exactly. We never get a lot of details as to what kind of deformities are happening or really why the infertility is happening. Science fiction it's happening. So the baby seems fine. It's a girl. And I forget the name of the baby or whatever. You find out that sometime later that apparently the baby turned out to be a shredder. And everyone says that it happened because Janine cheated on the commander and she used a doctor. And that by using the doctor is why the baby was a shredder, because she sinned or whatever. So again, all these things are blamed on the women and the handmaids.
So we haven't mentioned Nick.
Yeah, so who's Nick?
So because commander is very important, he has a car and a chauffeur.
Mm-hmm.
And the chauffeur's name is Nick. And you know, in the beginning, as she walks past Nick, they always kind of steal glances at each other. And sometime after the birth, I think, when she comes back from a shopping trip, Serena Joy is sitting in the garden in front of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And she calls her over, gives us a cigarette.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because normally, of course, we're not allowed to smoke.
Yeah.
And she says, "I have a deal for you."
Mm-hmm.
And she says, you know, the commander thing and the baby isn't happening.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, you know, Nick can help.
Yeah.
And if you do this, don't tell anybody, but I will find out something about your daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And of course, then, well, that was Serena Joy, right? We forgot the part where commander asked her to come and visit him.
Yeah, so it's, the timeline is very unclear. I forget which things happened first. So yeah, that Serena think, Joy happens after the birth. I think you're right, the commander happens first. So prior to the birth, maybe? At some point in time, the commander tells Nick to tell her to come to his office. Now,
like the handmaid is... After.
Yeah, the handmaid is not supposed to be with the commander by herself. Because one of the things about this whole ritual or whatever is that the handmaid's not supposed to be an object of sexual desire.
Another right? person, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. She's a tool to create a child. And she, you know, so she's breaking the rules by doing this. But he's summoning her. And Offred's very intelligent. Offred's very curious. And she's always kind of looking for opportunities and looking for things she can do. So she says, okay, he wants me to go. I'm going to go and see what this is about. And what's the first activity they do together in his office?
They play Scrabble.
Yeah. He just wants somebody to play Scrabble with. And she figures she's going to go and do some like crazy sex thing, or it's going to be like some kind of like ridiculous. And he like literally just wants to play Scrabble.
Right.
So they do.
And he lets her see some magazines so she can read. The only thing that he insists on, that's physical, is that he wants her to kiss him when she leaves.
As if she wants to.
Right.
Right.
And they start doing it like almost every night. There was the signal that he arranged with Nick. Like if Nick had wear his hat to the left or
something. Like that. Yeah, it was some like little thing that they did. So she had been going to see him. And one thing she thinks about is, you know, he must have done this before. Like, this, I can't be the first one. And there's actually evidence of that with the little Latin phrase.
So pseudo-Latin.
Yeah. So earlier in the story, in the closet.
Right. So earlier in the story, she describes her room, like, in gory details. Mm-hmm. And she said when she first got there, she would imagine being just in the room and there's nothing to do. So she would basically examine the whole room, like, in minute details.
Yeah.
And she found this phrase carved in a corner in the floor.
Yeah, I forgot where it was. Somewhere hidden in the room.
Somewhere hidden. And it said, roughly translated, it was like a pseudo-Latin, and basically said, don't let the bastards get you down.
Mm. But she didn't know what it meant. She just saw the Latin.
Right.
So she memorized it. And then one night with the commander, he was showing her a yearbook or a some book. And she saw the phrase again in Latin, and she was like, oh, like, what's that mean? And he laughed, and he's like, it's a joke, because it's kind of like pig Latin or pseudo Latin or whatever, and it means don't let the bastards grind you down. And that's when she sort of makes the connection, like, oh, there's been another handmaid in this seat before doing this, who carved that in the room for me to see.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting, the way that kind of communication goes across time.
Right.
You know,
that's what writing is, isn't it?
Oh, man. Ooh. Getting real meta over here. I get it.
There was also a scene, now I forget now where it fell into the story, where she fell asleep in the closet.
Oh, yeah, and the poor Martha. So she falls asleep in the closet. What, it was after something happens.
Maybe after the birth or something.
Yeah, something happens. She goes to her room and... She goes in, I think because the closet's where the thing is carved, where that phrase is carved, and she accidentally falls asleep there. And she wakes up the next morning and she terrifies one of the Marthas, and the Martha, like, screams and drops.
Because the Martha brings a breakfast every morning.
Right, and the Martha thinks, because apparently that's where the last handmaid had committed suicide, it was in the closet. And she's, the poor Martha, she's scared witless the rest of the day.
Right.
But because the Martha drops the tray and breaks something, they basically make a deal that the Martha won't mention that she was sleeping in the closet, and the handmaid won't mention that she broke something.
Right.
And so nobody finds out about it. But it was like, yeah, it was very interesting. So she kind of develops a relationship with Nick. This is the part of the story that gets fuzzy for me.
Right, so she goes to Nick, and Nick, you know, fulfills his duty.
Yeah.
But he doesn't seem to be that much into it, right? It's like, I guess the Serena Joy kind of must have given him something. And I think Serena Joy at one point shows her a photograph of her daughter.
Yeah.
Right.
And she sort of, Offer doesn't It's like she doesn't recognize her, but she's kind of like shocked by how
right.
much she's grown
right.
and how different she is, and how and she thinks about how her daughter doesn't know who she is at all, if she even thinks she's alive.
Right.
You know.
Right. Then there was the whole thing with the section called Jezebel.
Before we get to Jezebel, we've completely forgotten to talk about Mayday.
Oh. Well, we talked a little bit about the whisper campaign amongst the handmaids. So mm-hmm. apparently there's some kind of resistance movement. And Mayday is either its name or it's like
code word. It's its name, yeah. So one of the handmaids
what
she
was
walks
it, what
with,
was it in 1984? The Brotherhood?
Yeah, the Brotherhood.
It's the Brotherhood again.
Yeah, exactly. So Mayday is this like network of, you know, among the handmaids and stuff to...
Like, it sounds like a resistance movement that,
yeah.
that maybe something rescues... handmaids or
yeah.
something, it's not clear.
And so Offred thinks about, you know, once she finds out about it, she one of the women she interacts with, Offglen, the one she walks with to shopping every day, Offglen is the first one that really tells her about it.
I think there's like an interesting scene when they go in front of this printing shop
mm-hmm.
or something,
yeah.
and there's some interesting technology described in the window, like typewriters or something, or electronic typewriters.
Mm-hmm.
The
prayers or whatever, they you can like call in like a certain number of prayers to be printed.
Right,
machines.
Right.
And like the wives all do it because it like makes them look better in the eyes of the other wives and stuff. It's like totally
oh right,
ridiculous.
yes.
But that is actually another, that's a scene where the two of them want to talk freely to each other, and they go stand in front of that store because they believe that that store is not near microphones.
Right.
And it's not near other people who can see them. So that's kind of interesting, you know, the eyes and the campaign. Of
right, so that the, we
watched.
Didn't talk about this society structure, but yeah, they're being surveilled all the time. So let's talk about Jezebel's. So
yeah, so Jezebel's is a section of the story where the commander wants to go out.
Yeah, and he gets her address.
Yeah.
With feather boas.
Exceptionally gaudy dress.
And shoes with spikes.
Yeah. So they, you know, and she's kind of like, you know, a little surprised by the dress when everybody more or less sneaks her out. And they go to a bar or hotel.
It used to be a hotel.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, he has to sneak her out. She has to hide. And
he like makes her lay down in the car or something.
Right, right. Or maybe he gave a different color.
Yeah, so she wears the like gaudy boa dress, but then he also puts like another layer of something on her, like a different color dress to hide her. But then he also makes her lay down in the car. So it's like, there's a few layers of hiding. Like, it's again, clearly he's done this before.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
And
so they go to this, it's like a nightclub in a hotel, essentially.
Yeah.
And there's other women there and other men, and,
mm-hmm.
and they're partying,
mm-hmm.
sort of.
And they see Moira.
And she sees Moira, and Moira sees her, and they kind of signal each other to do the bathroom thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they meet in the bathroom again, and Moira tells her more about what happened to her after
mm-hmm.
she left the center. And of course then Commander and the handmaid go into the room
mm-hmm.
to try to make more babies,
mm-hmm.
right?
But it seems to be more like doing it without the ritual portion. It seems
right.
to be like
right.
more
it's
like actual, like an actual sexual encounter
right.
as opposed to like this weird ritual situation.
Did they go more than once to their?
I think just once. Wasn't there also a marriage ceremony at some point? Wasn't it like a wedding?
Right, there was a wedding and there was the salvaging. I think there was the.
Right, we should talk. Let's talk about the salvaging.
Yeah.
So the salvaging is. This kind of goes to what we were talking about in our last podcast with Hunger Games, and something I think we see a lot in dystopias, is the use of language to describe things in a way that makes them sound exceptionally different than they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, salvaging doesn't sound bad. Handmade doesn't sound bad. You know, this wife doesn't sound bad.
Right.
These things don't sound bad at all. The salvaging is like the handmaid's tearing someone apart and
essentially,
murdering
him. It's like a killing, yeah.
Yeah.
A ritual killing, essentially, what
yeah.
it is, yeah. So what were they killing him? Oh, there were some people.
Was he a rapist? I forget.
Yeah, well, I think one of
them. There's some alleged crime. They say,
right.
like, this person did the bad thing to a handmaid. Now all the handmaids kill him.
Right.
And it's exceptionally violent. I'm really curious to watch the TV show to see how it is depicted in the TV show, if it is depicted in the TV show. And it's sort of, there's this idea that it's not in the story proper, but in the epilogue, it's sort of talked about as this way to allow the handmaids, who are very, very, very repressed humans, to express their feelings and their anger in sort of one moment.
Right, and directed at somebody.
And directed at somebody. And I think it's very akin to, you haven't seen the Purge movies, have you?
No.
So the Purge is a series of horror movies. It's the idea is that for one day every year, you can kill anybody you want.
I see.
Or do any crimes you want. Right. Most people kill people. And that whole concept is, you know, we need to be able to release. And only through release can we
be nice.
Right, exactly. So it's kind of that same idea, which is interesting.
So that was also that same way. There was a wedding, I think,
where
the heroes, soldiers who came from the front,
mm-hmm.
got assigned wives.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, yeah, you're right. We can finish the story. So what happens mm-hmm. then? So there's a bunch of stuff going on. She goes, visits the commander, Evananda, and she's mm-hmm. having an affair with Nick. And then one evening, a van shows up
mm-hmm.
and they take her away.
Yep.
Typically, when a van shows up and takes a handmaid away, it's bad.
Yeah. Typically, when a van shows up and takes anyone away, it's bad.
Right.
Well, so what she sees, actually, earlier in the story, at least on one occasion, a van snatched somebody off the street.
Right.
When they're out
right.
shopping.
Right.
And generally, that's considered very bad. But she has reason to believe that it's here to save her.
Right. Again, from the text of the story, it's not clear.
Right.
So let's talk about the structure of society.
Sure. So we kind of talked a little bit about these different roles that are assigned. So for the men, there seems to be commanders.
Right.
They get the fancy wives. Then there seems to be like other people who get what are called Econo wives.
Right. Sound like there were soldiers who...
Yeah, so the wives themselves wear blue. Everything is color-coded, like I said before. The wives wear blue.
Right.
The Econo wives wear striped dresses. We only see them fleetingly. We don't really talk to her in a Econo wave. The handmaids wear red. The handmaids are only assigned to the commanders.
Right.
The Marthas, which are the servants, wear green.
Right.
The ants wear brown?
I think brown, yes.
Yeah, so the ants are the people that train the handmaidens at their red center.
And the wives wear blue.
Yeah, the wives wear blue.
Right.
And then there's guardians and there's angels. It seems to be soldiers or guards.
Right, the different kinds of guards. I think the angels sounded like the guards who were guarding handmaids, especially at the Red Center.
Mm-hmm.
And the guardians were just like random guards.
Yeah, it was kind of unclear. And then there are eyes, which are the spies.
Spies, right.
You know, which could be anyone. And as we kind of mentioned before, there's some kind of infertility happening in this whole thing in Gilead. And that's probably the most science fiction portion of the story, is the hand waving of like, and then chemicals made us infertile.
Right.
You know, oh, pollution. Like, I did some, for a science fiction reason, no one's having babies. That's basically the premise.
Right, right. And that's never really explained. So, I mean, we joke around this because in most of the other stories, the main character takes a break and reads a book that explains everything.
Yeah. Well, in this one instead, we go to a conference in the epilogue. And the conference is about right. Gilead.
So shall we talk about the epilogue then?
Yeah, let's talk about it, because we sort of talked about the structure and stuff. So the epilogue, I forgot how many years afterwards it is.
Quite a while after.
Right, so it's after the fall of Gilead.
Yeah.
So what we learn from that is that the reason of the rise of Gilead was because of this infertility. It's blamed generically on pollution. It seems to have been with white women, like specifically.
Hmm.
So there's a racial component in the story that isn't really explored, and I think that's just because of the lens we have, a very close point of view.
Well, so the thing that when we were discussing this at our book discussion group, somebody pointed out that if you look at the names of the scientists in the epilogue, they're all like Native American.
Yeah,
names.
All the speakers are have Native American names. Yeah, so this is really interesting. There's definitely something going on there. I just don't quite know what.
So one of the things they discuss in this conference at the end, they also discuss the origin of this text.
Yes.
Right. So it turns out that apparently they found cassette tapes. somewhere in Maine, in some house. Mm-hmm. And the cassette tapes looked like music tapes, but they were just disguised recordings by Off Red, mm-hmm. basically telling his story.
Right. And there was quite a lot of them. They, I forget how many they said, but there's quite a lot of them. So we know that she at least... Well, I mean, I guess we don't know if she made it to Maine, because we know the tapes made it there, but we don't know when she made them or...
Well, she certainly had enough time to make them, right?
Right.
So she was probably free for some period of time.
Well, as long as she was in Gilead, she wasn't free. She would have been in hiding.
Right.
So the question is, did she actually make it to Canada, which was the goal, right, to cross the border into not Gilead? I don't know. I'm back and forth on it. Like, whenever I think about it, I try to think, like, theme-wise, what fits better. It's a very Lady and the Tiger kind of thing. Have you
what
ever
do you
read?
Mean, no.
You ever read the short story, The Lady and the Tiger?
Maybe.
It's a, they make you read in, like, middle school. I forgot who the author is. The Lady and the Tiger is basically a princess has a love affair with, like, a low-born man, and her dad finds out. So he's like, you know, no, I'm not doing this. So we're taking this man, and we're going to put him in a coliseum, in a ring. And there's two doors. And behind one door is a tiger. And if the tiger comes out, the tiger's going to eat him. And behind the other door is another woman. And if he picks that door, he has to marry that woman. Either way, princess, you don't get to be with him. Mm. And princess finds out beforehand what's behind which door. And when he's in the coliseum, he looks at her, and she points to a door. And then the story ends. And the question is, what did she pick? So yeah, the question in The Lady and Tiger is, which door does she pick?
Right.
That's the point of the story, you know, it's like, if you, you know,
what... That's an impossible choice, and it's left to you.
Well, I think if you believe that she truly loved him, you would think that she wanted him to live and be with whoever else would be alive. But it kind of depends on how you read the princess's character.
Right.
So this is similar. It's like, do we need an answer? Does it matter?
Not really.
Yeah. I've been trying to kind of parse it out in terms of thematically.
She's doing a Lem.
Oh, God. Well, this comes back to Lem, doesn't it? I tend to think Offred did not make it out. Because I tend to think that while she had time to make these tapes, I find that the tapes being left in Maine, which would have been part of Gilead.
Well, it's not clear, because they could have found them hidden in some house in Maine after Gilead fell, right?
Well, then where were they in the interim? So I just think that we don't have a lot of evidence, but the evidence we do have is that Gilead seems to be particularly powerful. It's hard to escape, and the tapes are found within the borders of Gilead. If she really wanted to record her story and share it with people who would listen at the time that she existed, leaving them in Gilead wouldn't make sense.
Well, maybe she...
Bringing them to Canada
as she was escaping...
Sense.
You know, she made the tapes, and then perhaps the last part of the journey was in a little kayak, and she couldn't take anything with her.
Possibly,
so
but...
I'm an optimist, so I think she did escape, so...
I think it's a little bit more thematically cohesive if she doesn't escape, in that she's just kind of... She's just one of the handmaids. She's not special, she just happens to be the point of view that we have.
Right.
So, and the point is kind of like a dystopian society that crushes everyone. Hmm. You know, Winston Smith is crushed by Big Brother.
Right.
You know, he's not unique. He's just our point of view into the society. So I don't know, but I don't know. So let's talk about it in terms of a dystopia. So that's the plot. There's the plot of the story. Dystopia scale from 1984 to Brave New World.
Well, it's for 1984-ish, right?
Yeah.
There's a war going on, you know, so that's one of the excuses for all this stuff. There's been some kind of what seems like a natural disaster that prevents children being born. Mm-hmm. So they have this weird structure. There's some influence of religion. It's interesting that she doesn't say which sects there might be. That they do mention killing Baptists, mm-hmm. right? So it's not Baptist. And it's not even clear that it's necessarily Christian, mm-hmm. although the commander reads the Bible.
Right, but so the interesting way that religion is used is, like, Offred seems to remember that some passages of the Bible before this whole Gilead thing, and she knows at the Red Center that some things they're reading are wrong, that they've been edited. So it's not, it doesn't seem to be, whoever's like spearheading Gilead doesn't seem to be like someone who is genuinely, or a group that is genuinely concerned with like the truisms of faith or whatever, because then you wouldn't be editing your holy
right.
text.
Right.
It seems to be being used as a tool from the limited amount we get to see of what is being said. Not really a lot of technology.
Yeah, there was right. So this is the question: is it science fiction or not? And Margaret Atwood herself said about this book that it's speculative fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what's the difference?
Right. Exactly.
I mean, you can get persnickety about stuff like that, but you know, what's the point?
I mean, I think by nature of being a dystopia, it has to be science fiction because dystopia is a type of science fiction, right?
Well, no, dystopias are just dystopias.
I think a dystopia is a subset of science fiction. What other kind of dystopia is there? It has to be science fiction to be a dystopia.
I'm trying to think of Gulliver's Travels. I suppose you could even consider that a little bit of science fiction.
Yeah, I think so.
And fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because these lines kind of get blurred. But it's like really in this story, it's the lack of technology that's kind of jarring. Especially thinking about, you know, if Offred went from living in a society more or less like ours.
Right.
You know, where you have the internet, the touch of your fingertips on your phone.
Right, right.
I mean, we're sitting in a room right now and there's dozens of pieces of technology around us. And to go from that to...
an empty room.
An empty room. Oh, God, I'd be so bored. It's pretty jarring, and I think that... I wonder if science fiction, because science fiction contemplates often new technologies or changes in technology, I wonder if technology regression and the removal of that technology is also a science fiction thing.
Actually, probably, because you can think of this whole genre of these things where you travel backwards in time into the Stone Age.
Right. That's similar, yeah. It definitely is. I would consider it science fiction, I think. You think it's science fiction?
Yeah. I'm not that particular.
And what about themes?
You want to talk about themes?
I always want to talk about themes. There's so many. I'm so happy. So the first thing I want to say about this story is that this is a story that has absolute high literary merit. And I think I've mentioned this before in the podcast, that that's an extremely difficult thing to identify. And last time with The Hunger Games, I was just able to say that doesn't have high literary merit.
Yeah, it was kind of what I found kind of funny, because when we talked about the voice in which the book is written, large chunks of this book are written in this historical present.
Right, the present tense, yeah.
So,
and that was
Hunger
my
Games.
Complaint about The Hunger Games, yeah.
But here I found it really effective.
Well, because she uses it for a purpose, because so much of the story is memory.
Mm-hmm.
When she remembers things, it's in the past tense. And then when things are happening, it's in the present tense. So there's a consciousness to it that is very effective. And I think does sort of put you in the moment with Offred. That does work. The writing is beautiful in the story. And I could sit here and go through hundreds of quotes. I highlighted like half of this book on my Kindle when I was reading it. It's if you haven't read it, if you don't read it for any other reason, but that the writing is beautiful... Someone at one of our book discussion groups, I think Charles, said something along these lines, and I thought it was very apt. The narrator has a very strong character, she has an interest in language. The narrator herself has an interest in language. This is probably a reflection of Margaret Atwood having an interest in language. But the narrator has an interest in language and in images and in thought and in connections between things. And it comes through in the writing, and it is a pleasure to read it just because of
the quality. But it's like it puts the image in your head, right?
Oh, yeah.
So I did not want to watch the movie or anything, just not to have prejudiced kind of the image. But like when she describes the empty room, you see the empty room.
Oh, absolutely. Wait, now I'm opening my Kindle to find this. I was open to a quote before. So there's a lot of stuff with color, and I'll get to color in a minute as a motif, but... this is just an example of some of the writing. This is very early on in the story. She's outside in the summer describing the garden. And she says, "The tulips along the border are redder than ever, opening, no longer wine cups, but chalices, thrusting themselves up. To what end? They are, after all, empty. When they are old, they turn themselves inside out, then explode slowly, the petals thrown out like shards." Come on.
Right.
That's so good.
Right.
that's so loaded, and it's like the language and the use of images and things like that. And I mean, this is clearly a metaphor regarding fertility and everything like that. And the handmaids, you know, wearing red, the tulips being red, et cetera, et cetera. It's not all that complicated. But the use of the language to draw those kinds of pictures and make those kinds of comparisons is what gives it high literary merit, in my opinion. And it's what allows there to be themes. It allows it allows the story to be trying to make a point. So I made a big list of themes, but I'll just pick a few. I think identity is probably one of the biggest themes, and that kind of is related to individuality versus the collective as well. So women particularly, the men too, but to a lesser extent, but the women particularly are literally color-coded for your convenience.
Right.
So you can know who they are. This is a handmaid. They're color-coded, so like, this is a handmaid.
Right.
She wears red. This is a Martha. She wears green. This is a wife. She wears blue. And that kind of organization of people eliminates identity.
Right.
And one thing Offred struggles with is trying to remember who she was.
Right.
And trying to figure out who she is now.
Right.
So identity is definitely a huge thing. The fact that Moira escapes by dressing up as an aunt and getting out is like taking advantage of the understanding of identity within the society.
It's actually interesting. She just puts the clothes on of somebody else, and all of a sudden you're some completely different person. Right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Completely different rights and everything.
It kind of has an interesting historical parallel. So back in the day when women and men's clothing were much more strictly adhered to, like women like didn't wear trousers, for example, mm-hmm. when there's a lot of historical examples of women who would just dress up as men and just pass as men, because no one ever even thought that a woman could wear men's clothing.
Well, I became 12 knight.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, no one even thought, it didn't even cross their minds that a woman could wear, like, a suit or, like, armor or something like that.
Right.
And I actually have a friend on the interwebs who does a lot of research into LGBT history, and so she posts a lot about it, so I read a lot of her things. And there's, like, a lot of examples of women who just dressed up as men and just lived as dudes, and nobody ever thought about it. Because the clothing is how they identify the person, as opposed to, like, the individual. And it kind of has to do with class and things like that.
Right.
And then I'll just talk about two more. So individuality versus the collective. There's kind of this interesting idea going on in Gilead that, like, this institution of the handmaids had to happen because otherwise we would not have enough children for society to continue. And
well, I think you jump into conclusions. You assume that that's why they're doing it, right?
I think that they say it in the epilogue that they were having a serious population crisis, and you know, maybe they could have reconstituted their society to deal with fewer people, but they didn't want to. They wanted to continue their society, so they created this whole scheme to try to support it. You know, it's obviously this is written as a dystopia and everything like that, but kind of the idea of how you value your own individual autonomy and choices versus how you value the collective that you live in, and how people give up things for that collective, willingly or otherwise.
Right.
And it's kind of a wartime kind of theme.
Right, and again, that goes back to 1984, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of the things that they were able to impose on people was, well, it's for the war effort.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I mean, that has a lot of historical parallels, too.
Yeah.
That people, you know, you do.
And people do that.
Yeah. It's a great way to get people to do things. Let's try to get them together for that. And the last one I'll talk about, because I could continue for a long time, is self-preservation versus self-actualization. So as a side note, I recently saw the movie Frozen 2. I highly recommend it. I love Frozen 2. It's very good. I know you haven't seen it, but you should. It comes out on Blu-ray in a few days. I'm going to get it. Frozen 1 was about self-identity. Frozen 2 is about self-actualization.
Huh?
So there's a difference. Figuring out who you are is the first step.
Okay.
And then living as you are is the second step.
I see.
And, like, actually carrying that out. So Offred knows who she is, so she doesn't need to figure it out. She knows who she is, right? So what she's struggling with is self-preservation, like just staying, literally staying alive, versus self-actualization, which is what humans tend to want once their basic needs are met is the desire to actualize wants and aspirations and dreams and ideas. That's what she can't do.
Right.
And she was a person who could do that before.
Right.
And I think for me, thinking about going from a situation where, you know, I have the freedom to self-actualize, right? From going from that to a situation where it's only strictly about preservation is very depressing and very...
That's what makes this book scary in many mm-hmm. ways because of that. Yeah. And I guess I was going to say, when you were talking about her writing, I'm not as attuned to the writing as you are, not being an English major. However, I think the effect that she, a good writing gives you, that you get into the story more. So it's like mm-hmm. you have, I was very unhappy reading parts of this story.
Yeah.
Because it's an unhappy story.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Which is what I think she escaped at the end.
Thematically, I think that she probably didn't escape. But we can discuss this more off the podcast. There's a really easy motif here. If you're writing for your high school English paper, the motif is color. Things are color-coded. The color is important. Literally every time. Anytime anyone says anything about color, it matters. If something's red, it has something to do with the handmaids, and guess what? It's a metaphor. If something's green, it has something to do with Martha's, and guess what? It's a metaphor. Every single time. It's kind of awesome. I mean, I love that kind of consistency as an English major.
That was a little bit too obvious, but...
It's one of those things where that's for your high school report, you know, the motif is color.
Okay.
You know, it's not a crazy stuff here.
But I suppose, you know, it's like if you want to say putting people in uniforms makes people all the same, so mm-hmm. you kind of reduce the envy kind of mm-hmm. as one of deadly sins or whatever.
Well, but jealousy. I think the way they do it with the women is they sort of increase it. Because the society is kind of dependent on the women hating each other, right? This is, you know, it's kind of dependent on the wives not liking the handmaids, the handmaids not liking the wives, the Martha's not liking the handmaids. There's, you know, if they wanted all of the women to be on equal footing, they would all be, but they're not. And I think, I kind of questioned why the handmaids were red. And I think Evelyn gave us the best answer when we went to the first science fiction group.
Uh-huh.
And she said, you know, it's a color associated with fertility. And that's true.
Okay.
You know, it certainly is. And there's plenty of things that Alfred sees that are associated with fertility. It's also associated with violence and
blood,
sin, I guess, in a related way. It's also a color associated with passion and...
Prostitution, you know, red light districts.
Right. But that's interesting because the handmaids are supposed to be...
Pure, in a way.
They're non-sexual sexual objects. So yes. they're women whose only role is to have sex with someone. But they're not supposed to be sexually attractive.
Right.
So it's a very interesting, like, the color choice is very interesting. Because I would think if you were going to go for, like, fertility without the sex, you'd go for, like, green. You know, green is like spring,
yeah.
You know, but I don't know. It's neat.
I just remembered one of the little things that happens in the book where all the handmaids want to get moisturizer.
Oh, yeah.
They steal butter.
Yeah, they steal butter and use it.
And just speaking about not being asexual, so they weren't allowed to have any cosmetics or anything like that.
I think the last thing we're going to do is talk about our favorite things in the story. I think we're going to talk about... I don't think we have very similar ones. What was your favorite thing?
I think, well, the fact that she escaped. Actually, I liked the epilogue, right?
Yeah.
Because it was kind of an interesting explanation for everything. I think the writing kind of was very effective, so...
Yeah, I loved the writing. My favorite thing was the structure of the story. I like non-linear stories.
Mm, yeah.
I think my other favorite thing we ever read was Arrival, or the Story of Your Life, which was the short story that the movie Arrival was based on. That was also non-linear. I like non-linear structures. I find them really interesting.
It's funny, it was done so well that you weren't confused. Like, you kind of...
Yeah. Well, no, the whole point of using a non-linear story is so that you reveal your climaxes to the reader towards the point in the story where it would naturally be a climax, right? You know, because if this was a linear time-wise, I mean, so you and I sat here and typed up the, you know, the linear plot before we did this. If you were following it linearly, the climax would be the very, very end when she gets into the truck. But the climax, there's multiple different climaxes. There's how, you know, her actual memory of how her daughter was taken from her ultimately during the during the thing. There's these various ceremonies, but particularly the salvaging being so violent. You know, there's lots of things. And so what the nonlinear aspect of it allows is for those high drama moments to be closer together in the text.
Right.
Even when they're time-wise not close to each other. So if it's done correctly, yeah, it's definitely, it's very effective. It's just like in the story of your life. So
and well, the epilogue was kind of funny. I was kind of actually surprised because I didn't really expect anything like that in the end.
Hmm.
You know, the ending of her escaping, maybe, to me was a perfect logical ending. There was no...
Without the epilogue, we would have... I think what I like about the epilogue is that it gives more of a realistic tone to her story because it explains why it is how it is, and that it's these tapes. And that's the other thing, too, is the order they explain in the epilogue. Like, the tapes were discovered, listened to, transcribed, and then ordered as best as they could manage.
Right.
But they couldn't really figure out, you know, they'd have no idea what order she actually recorded them in. And I kind of like that aspect of the epilogue.
There's a sequel now.
Yeah, it just came out, right? What's it called? The Testament.
The Testament. But I haven't read it. I'm not sure if I'm going to read it.
I might read it. One of our friends at the book discussion group said it's like quite a ways in the future off of this.
Hmm.
So I guess it would be between Alfred's story and the epilogue.
Right.
Some future Gilead situation.
All right, so let's just talk about what we're going to do next.
Oh, can I talk about one more thing?
Yeah.
I brought it up earlier and told... So the last thing I talk about is this question that the story raises is, can you consent to sex that you have no power to deny? And this is a theme, or theme, I don't know, issue that also comes up in A Song of Ice and Fire. So I've talked about it a lot before with other people. And it's a really interesting issue, I think. And I don't think there's a clear answer of how the text feels about it. We know how Alfred feels about it with the ritual with the commander. She doesn't consider... From what I remember from the text, she doesn't consider it rape because she considers it, like, she's consensually participating. And to an extent, she is, you know, she's not kicking and screaming and trying to run and trying to scratch anyone or like, physically fighting. But she's not because she knows she can't.
She's living under threat, I mean, you know.
Right.
If you don't do this, we're going to kill you, so
yeah,
it's kind of tough, right?
Right. So it's similar in A Song of Ice and Fire... or Game of Thrones, they have the same issue where Daenerys marries Khal Drogo right in the beginning of the series, and they get married and they have sex after they get married. And question is always, you know, was that... And I mean, this is a question, too. It used to be... They used to not think that you could be raped within a marriage, but you can. The question with Daenerys and Khal Drogo was like, well, was it consensual? And in the books, it's a little bit more gray. In the show, it's pretty obviously a rape in the first episode. In the books, it's a little bit more gray because Khal Drogo basically like waits for her to say yes. But she is 13 and he's in his 30s. And she couldn't say no. Because she could, if she had said no, it's not like he would have listened.
Well, I mean, this is kind of a general problem that humans have in life, that there are certain things that come up. In theory, you have free will to go one way or the other, but many times you have no choice and you have to act a particular way.
Right.
Right, for whatever reasons. I mean, having gun pressed to your head is one, right? But there are more subtle, I guess, reasons.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, if you consent to have sex with someone and you have sex and it's fine, and then in reality that person would not have taken no for an answer. You know, was the sex, did that nullify the consent you just gave? Even if you didn't know, you couldn't consent to it.
That's a way too meta.
Yeah. But I think it's a really interesting question. I think it's the right kind of questions for literature to be asking. Mm. And it's the right kind of issue for literature to be exploring. I don't know that there is a straight answer. I don't know that we have...
I think that's probably just a whole question of morality in general. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, when you know there's the right thing to do, but if you do it, then you can suffer some very bad consequences.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do?
Right. Well, I think it's also like, you know, would you think of the commander as a rapist? You know, when we think of rapists, we think of like violent and evil and morally debauched and like all of these things. And it's like, you know, I don't know that he would be, that I would think of him as a rapist. But,
well, so it's
but
like
he had sex with her and she couldn't not consent to it.
So was Peter in the Hunger Games a thief?
For what?
He took bread from his parents and gave it to Katniss.
Well, he was supposed to be feeding that bread to the pigs. But yeah, no, I get your point. It's sort of, I think like we don't have enough language yet in the conversation to describe the different layers of this kind of situation. And so I think it's very interesting. And I think is the kind of thing that literature should be exploring.
Right.
And I don't know what the answer is. It certainly, I wouldn't say it was consensual sex because if she couldn't have.
But the other way you can take the cultural relativism kind of point of view.
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of depends what kind of world you live in, right? So back in the Middle Ages, marrying somebody who was 13 was just normal
mm-hmm.
and expected. And nobody thought that was bad.
Mm-hmm.
And today we don't approve of that anymore.
Yeah. Well,
was it bad then?
I don't know. I wasn't then. I wasn't there then.
But that's what I mean. So it's like, you know, some of these things may be absolutes, but some are not. Some are relative too. So in Gilead, it's perfectly normal for the commander to have sex with a handmaid.
That's the point, right? That's the whole point.
That's everybody expected it.
Right.
You know, why would you even try to avoid it?
Mm-hmm.
That's the way the world is, you know?
Yeah. It's very interesting. So I like that. I like that topic being explored, and I like that the narrator has an opinion on it, because you don't necessarily have to agree with the narrator.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things, actually, she says, it's that the aunts kept saying, it's like, you, who lived during the transition, remember what it was like before,
mm-hmm.
but once you're gone, the next generation is not going to know what it was before.
Mm-hmm.
They're just going to know what it is now, therefore it's going to be just normal.
Right, it's going to be easier for them. Right, exactly.
Which is kind of the same point, right? So you think it's wrong because it was differently be in the past,
mm-hmm.
but if it's always been this way,
mm-hmm.
right, it's fine.
Right. Very meta. Okay, so I think that is our discussion on The Handmaid's Tale. What are we doing next? Are we pick a book?
So I decided.
Oh, okay.
That we're going to do two short stories.
Okay.
One by Ursula Le Guin.
Cool, okay, good.
You know, the ones who...
Oh, the ones who walk away from Omelas.
Right.
Oh, I love that story. Yeah, you'll like that.
And
okay.
Then I picked a story by Tim Chung, whose name, I can't remember the title of it, but it's also an interesting technological innovation, how it affects society.
Mm.
And it has like two different views of the idea. And it's really a great story.
Cool. The ones who walk away from Omelas is like a really cool story. And it's a very good story to read in like middle school with kids, because it you know, gives you like a great moral dilemma, except that there's like a random paragraph in the middle where there's an orgy. But other than that, it's fine.
Okay. And maybe after that we can do like utopias everywhere.
Yes.
Or dystopias, or whatever.
Is it a dystopia or a utopia? I don't know.
Well, I think this one is probably a dystopia. I don't think there's a utopia for anybody here.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. It's like, because the commander didn't seem very happy either.
No, it's like 1984.
Well, at least in 1984 you got the sense that there was the inner party that was benefiting.
Sort of, but they were not that, didn't sound that happy.
Hmm. I'm also really interested in the different ways we've discovered in these books that they world build. So we have sit down and read, we have sit down and talk to an old man, we have a conference afterwards about it.
So another one, so I think I mentioned it, I started to read Play a Piano by Kurt Vonnegut.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, the way the world built, there's a guest from Saudi Arabia who came to look at your town and your factory. So you give him a background.
Oh, great. Well, that's like Brave New World. They start with like the students in the beginning.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
like,
right.
Oh, let me explain to you students all about this fertilization. Like, okay, cool. I get it. You made a thing and you want to tell me about it. I get it. All right, I think that's everything for this episode. Thank you for listening to this episode of History in Reverse, and we'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye. hot takes.
We have speed.
We have speed. Why are you wearing headphones and I'm not? I don't get headphones?
No, I was just checking to make sure that everything
is... Can you hear me while your headphones are on?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Cool. Fancy. All right. I'm going to just put the timer on over here. I mean, if you want to wear the headphones, you can. I'm not
I just want to
shaming you out of
verify that, things are working. That's all.
God, okay. How do I introduce this?